Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Patentable Subject Matter Edition. Hi everyone, I'm Adam Ossoff, Associate Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. Today, I'm honored to moderate a debate between two distinguished law professors on Bilski v. Dole, on which the Supreme Court granted cert earlier in the month of June. Our two experts discussing the case are Joshua Sarnoff and Michael Frisch. Joshua Sarnoff is a professor of the practice of law at the Washington College of Law, American University, where he teaches patent law and co-directs the Glushko Samuelson Intellectual Property Law Clinic. On the other side of our virtual podium is Michael Risch, who is an associate professor of law at the West Virginia University College of Law, where he teaches courses on patent law, trade secrets, and cyber law. He also directs the Entrepreneurship, Innovation, and Law program there. Normally, I'd use everyone's honorific titles, but since we're all friends here, let's just go with first names. Welcome, Josh and Michael. We are very lucky to have these two scholars with us today to discuss Bilski, as they are not only experts in patent law generally, they are very knowledgeable about this particular case. They each filed competing amicus briefs when the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit heard the case en banc last year. Now I'll take a few minutes to briefly summarize the facts and procedural posture of the case, and then I'll turn it over to Josh and Michael to discuss its broader legal and policy dimensions. So let's begin. The Bilski case arose from a patent application filed in the Patent and Trademark Office by Bernard Bilski and Rand Warsaw for an invention known in patent law circles as a business method. In essence, their patent claimed a method for hedging risks in the sale of commodities. The patent examiner rejected their application on the grounds that it was directed to what's known in patent parlance as non-patentable subject matter. Section 101 of the Patent Act provides that a patent can only issue for four types of inventions: a process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter. The examiner concluded that the Bilski and Warsaw method did not fall within any of the relevant statutory categories. More specifically, that their business method was not a patentable process. The inventors appealed to the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences, and the board affirmed the examiner's decision. The inventors then appealed to the Federal Circuit, the special court that has sole jurisdiction to hear all patent appeals. The Federal Circuit, sua sponte, took the case en banc, and in a decision last October in 2008, it affirmed the decisions below that the claimed method on hedging risks in the sale of commodities was not patentable. In his majority opinion, Chief Judge Michel developed a two-pronged disjunctive test for determining whether a claimed method counts as a patentable process under Section 101. The process must either be tied to a particular machine or transform a particular physical state. This test came to be called the machine or transformation test. Bilski and Warsaw's method was deemed to fail this test because it was not tied to any particular machine in using it, nor did it transform any physical state in its operation. The court held that their business method was merely an idea of how to hedge risk in commodity sales, which it concluded was not something Section 101 permitted to be patented. Bilski and Warsaw immediately filed a cert petition, and the Supreme Court granted cert on the issue of whether the machine or transformation test is a valid test in applying the patentable subject matter requirements of Section 101, especially since this new test makes it impossible to patent many new business methods. The court also certified a second question of whether a patentable subject matter test that is anti-business methods is even valid, given Congress's implied validation of business method patents in Section 273 of the patent statutes. At root, the concern here is about what inventions will fall under the protection of the property rights provided by the patent system, thereby securing innovation and long-term progress of the useful arts and sciences in this country. With that, I'm now going to turn it over to Michael. Both Michael and Josh will give brief introductory statements, and then we'll have a general dialogue for the rest of the podcast. Michael?
Thank you, Adam. I'm very glad to be here on this podcast, and I appreciate the opportunity to debate these subjects with Josh, who is a worthy opponent. I'd like to start with the language of the statute. As you just said, Section 101 says that machines, manufacturers, compositions of matter, and processes are patentable. Now, historically, these terms have been construed quite broadly. The Supreme Court, in a case that ruled that life was patentable, said that everything under the sun made by man is patentable, and this follows from the legislative history. Now, the Bilski patent is a process, and historically, processes have also been determined to be quite broad. Thus, I argue in a recent Tennessee Law Review article called "Everything is Patentable," that everything is patentable. And this is historically true and normatively right. historically, subject matter restrictions have all been based on problems with the underlying merits of the patent, obviousness, novelty, specification, all of the things that are required to get a patent. In making rejections, however, based on the underlying merits, the court has always had dicta that's repeated in every case about how abstract ideas, natural principles, etc., are not patentable. And the problem is, over time, this dicta has had very little meaning in practice and has been extremely difficult to apply, as we see in Bilski, which I'm sure we'll talk about. The better route, I believe, is to treat subject matter as it's set forth in the statute. If a subject matter falls within one of the categories, it should be patentable, and if it does not, it should not. And then we should rigorously apply all of the other patentability hurdles to patents in order to weed out bad patents.
So first, let me express my thanks to Adam and to Scotusblog for having me and given the opportunity to engage with Michael in person rather than on paper on this really important topic. I think Michael frames the issue exactly right, which is why not let a lot in at the threshold and then apply other criteria rigorously to decide what is worthy of granting the government property right of a patent for a disclosed invention. So it's important to understand why we have Section 101, and as Michael also says, it has four specific terms: process, machine, manufacture, and composition of matter, and those are terms both of inclusion and exclusion. So the question is, why should we have any exclusion at the threshold? And the answer is both historical and practical, that Section 101 performs a function of industrial policy and research and development organization for our country by stating where you can get these kinds of rights and therefore what kind of funding should be directed based on the promise of exclusive rights, and what kinds of funding and other types of research and development activity should be developed and directed through other means. In particular, reflecting constitutional language, there are three concerns with a broad grant of patentability to particular fields. The first is that in some fields, granting patent protection may do more harm than good by providing few incentives for innovation but significant exclusion that diminishes sequential innovation. The second is that the patent system simply may not be for things that are not technology, so we clearly limit the patent system away from things like music and art, which are inventions of the mind equally and of creative effort that often requires significant investment. And the third, again, historical, is we wouldn't grant patents for things that people thought were immoral. Interestingly, from an 1890 seminal patent treatise, sometimes these things go together, so that William Robinson in this treatise said, to benefit by the discoveries of his fellow men is thus not only a natural right, it's also the natural duty which every man owes to himself and to society, and the mutual universal progress thence resulting is the fulfillment of the earthly destiny of the human race, conveying the belief which then was reflected in historic exclusions from patentable subject matter for laws of nature, naturally occurring materials, and abstract ideas, that scientists had a duty to freely disclose their discoveries, and the consequence not only was not to suggest that these were human inventions, but also it would promote universal progress, being a case where the patent system would do more harm than good. That leads us to the actual meaning of the words under Section 101 and how broadly or narrowly to construe them, and unlike Michael, I tend to think, and the courts have tended to think, that the word, at least process, has to be construed much more narrowly than its potentially broad meaning of any series of steps of any kind. And the last thing I'll say before we really kind of engage the patent at issue in the history is that the legislative history to which Michael refers actually didn't support the Supreme Court decision that he mentions, although they cited the legislative history for that broad purpose to the statutory language. What the legislative history actually said was focused on a different context, and said a person may have, quote, invented a machine or manufacturer, which may include anything under the sun that's made by man, but it's not necessarily patentable under Section 101 unless the conditions of the title are fulfilled, suggesting that where you met those two particular categories of patentable subject matter with an actual invention, you still had to jump through the other titles, saying nothing about the scope being broad for those particular categories. So let me stop and we can move forward.
Excellent. That puts it right back into Michael's court in a very nice way. Perhaps, Michael, you can comment on on how we ended up in a place where there seems to be this kind of broad discretionary authority that courts seem to have in construing very specific express terms in a statute, which may seem to run counter to some people's understanding of statutes, that you should follow the text of the statute closely.
Well, I'm not entirely sure how we got where we are, because the patent system has always been treated differently than other administrative agencies. But I have a theory about subject matter specifically. If you look at historically at the cases, in the Supreme Court at least, they all look to the statute. For example, in the O'Reilly v. Morse case, which was in the 1850s and dealing with the telegraph, Morse had claimed all communications using electromagnetic signals, and the court ruled that this was invalid. They ruled that it was too broad. Now, if you look at the specific language of the case, it really says that Morse did not clearly describe and what patent people call enable. He didn't describe how to make all communication methods over electromagnetic signals. He only described how to make one of them, namely his specific telegraph. And so they said that what he was claiming was too broad for what he had described in his patent. That follows the statute. But then the court goes on to say, oh, and by the way, this is a natural principle and you can't patent principles and ideas. And so the language from O'Reilly v. Morse gets parroted forward. I call it parroting dicta in my article. It gets repeated by the court, always in dicta, because the court always looks to the underlying merits, except a very few cases. Now, the problem we have is when you get to the Federal Circuit, or this its predecessor, the Court of Claims, the CCPA, they have to follow Supreme Court precedent, and what they're trying to do is interpret all of this dicta and turn it into something that can be a usable test, and that's what we see in Bilski. So we wind up divorced from the statutory language, even though the court, as it's invalidating patents, says that the statutory language is broad.
To some extent, I wholly agree that that's what the courts of appeals are doing. They're trying to make sense out of the Supreme Court statements on these issues. But there's a longer story to the exclusions from patentability as statutory interpretations of the legislative language, which has been in the Act in essentially unchanged form since the initial statute of 1790. So reading from a case from 1817 where Justice Story was writing circuit, he said, it has often been decided that a patent cannot be legally obtained for a mere philosophical or abstract theory. It can only be for such a theory reduced to practice in particular structure or combination of parts. In short, the patent must be for a specific machine, substantially new in its structure and mode of operation, and not merely changed in form or in the proportion of its parts. That was probably the first incorporation into U.S. law of the idea that you can't patent a mere abstract idea. You had to patent something that was more thing-like in the application of the idea to perform a particular function that we wanted to see performed and reward. You get to the O'Reilly case. O'Reilly actually incorporates language from a British case, Nielsen v. Harford, which also talks about the exclusion for laws of nature, naturally occurring materials, and abstract ideas, and also suggests that those things must be treated as if they were already known. And then you can forward yourself yet another 100 years or so to the Benson case, in the Supreme Court, which was dealing with the patentability of computers, saying phenomena of nature, though just discovered, mental processes and abstract intellectual concepts are not patentable, as they're the basic tools of scientific and technological work. So what you see throughout the centuries is a concern that the patent law was limited to a particular set of domains by statutory interpretation of what Congress originally had meant to apply it to. And the question is since Congress hasn't weighed in very much, did Congress grant the discretion to the courts to expand the subject matter to not only technologies as they developed over time, but to things that we don't think of as technologies, things like business methods applied over the internet, or even just human interactions? And that's really what the current debate is about. It's because Congress hasn't spoken, we're interpreting a current statute in light of 200 or so years of history, where the courts had interpreted the language to be much more restrictive.
Josh, with respect to the question of did Congress grant discretion to the courts in this particular area, hasn't then that been impliedly answered through the American Inventors Protection Act of 1999, which followed the Federal Circuit's decision in State Street Bank in 1998, which expressly approved for the first time, at least in the case law, the holding that business methods were patentable. And then, as you know, in the American Inventors Protection Act adds Section 273 to the patent statutes, which provides for a prior user rights defense to patents on methods, in which Section 273A3 defines a method as a method of doing or conducting business.
Well, again, it really depends on how you read the legislative history of that provision. You're absolutely right as to what 273A3 says. And what 273A3 is a definition as a predicate to is 273B1, which says it shall be a defense to an action for infringement with respect to any subject matter that would otherwise infringe one or more claims for a method in the patent being asserted if such person had, acting in good faith, actually reduced the subject matter. In other words, if somebody had used it before within the last year it got patented, then you couldn't assert the patents against them, which clearly implies legislative recognition of the existence of business method patents. But that's a far cry from legislative approval for them. In fact, it's a restriction on the rights that are being granted to them by the courts. And it seems to me an even farther stretch to say that Congress thereby impliedly ratified the Federal Circuit's interpretation that Section 101 was extremely broad. In fact, what they did say, quoting from Charles Schumer, who was a senator who was very concerned with this issue, was, Section 273 should be viewed as just the first step in defining the appropriate limits and boundaries of the State Street decision. I believe it's time for Congress to take a closer look at the potentially broad and perhaps adverse consequences of the State Street decision. That suggests Congress didn't like the decision. It recognized that the law had been changed and was trying to figure out what to do with it. Usually you don't say that Congress has locked in an earlier judicial determination when they express disapproval of it but don't actually overrule it yet.
Michael, is there anything that you would like to particularly respond to in terms of the issue of whether the courts are limited to domains set forth by Congress, or has Congress actually approved of or signaled to the courts that they are to continue to have a broad discretionary authority in construing the patents for unpredictable or unforeseen innovation?
Well, that's a two-part question, I think. The first question is, does the Supreme Court or any court have the ability to interpret a statute that is vague? And I think the answer has to be yes, just like it is with every other statute. Now, does the court have the authority to interpret a statute that is vague in such a way as to enhance policy for innovation? I think people disagree with that, and I think they disagree about what's going to lead to innovation. I would say, as a general matter, policy is a good thing to consider when you're dealing with a vague statute and you're trying to interpret it, but it's not the only thing you look to. You have to look to what the rest of the statute says. So, for example, I read 273 very differently than Josh does. in my mind, where there's a court case that says business benefit patents are included in the definition of process, and the response from Congress to that is, okay, but people who used business methods in the past aren't liable for infringement, that tends to bolster that the interpretation is the one that Congress intended, because if Congress did not intend that, they could have overruled it. Now, there may be a public choice problem, of course, where they couldn't get the votes to overrule the interpretation, but that's something that folks have never, well, while being concerned with, have to live with. And Congress has overruled other statutory interpretations by the court in the patent area, and this could have been one of them, and it wasn't.
Michael, Josh has made some really interesting and far-ranging historical and policy claims, and I was wondering if you had any responses to that.
Yes, I think we view the same history differently, and maybe we're not as far apart as it seems. So, for example, when we talk about Justice Story's comments about an invention being reduced to practice and not changed in form or proportion, what he's really talking about is the concept of utility, that something must be practically useful, and has to do something. And he's talking about obviousness, that the new machine can't be obvious. It has to be, back in those days, it was called invention. Similarly, with the Nielsen case, that case was the principle that if you blow hot air on a fire, the fire will be stoked better, the fire will get hotter. And the patent was a very simple implementation of that. And so the whole distinction between idea and application is very difficult to draw. And a couple of historical patents that came out at the time show this. For example, patent 3264 from 1843 is a method for ascertaining the center of gravity of a vessel. And patent 13044 from 1855 is for a method of tuning an accordion to require but four forms of fingering. And then there's another patent for measuring, a method of measuring and cutting a garment, and another one that was a slide rule for calculating interest. And even if we look at the O'Reilly versus Morse, they allowed a patent for a system of signs for use for telegraphic purposes. The modern-day equivalent would be the ASCII character set, which is a system of binary codes used for communication over a digital computer. I believe Josh would say, wait a minute, that's just an algorithm. That's the kind of thing that should be excluded, when in fact the court in Morse approved that for use in telegraphy. So I believe that if you look historically, what we're now calling business methods are nothing new.
I guess we really do read the history somewhat differently. It's true that some of those patents issued. It's also true it's not clear whether those patents were valid. There are a number of cases that, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, that really focus on, I think, why this is not just about utility or obviousness. I'll give an example from the Brogdex case, where the patent was to a apple that was treated with a borate preservative. Clearly didn't exist in nature, clearly was the product of human ingenuity, and the court said that that really didn't transform the thing from a naturally occurring apple in a way that brought it within the scope of the patent system. It also really pushes the issue of what's the problem. And again, I think that you can say that, you know, we shouldn't have a patent for things that aren't useful. We shouldn't have a patent for things that are obvious because those do innovation harms. Or for the non-useful, it's just a waste of everyone's time. Maybe it, you know, misleads people into purchasing things that they shouldn't. But that's not really where these exclusions historically came from. Where they came from was constitutional and later statutory concern as interpreted by the judges that there were certain things, certain areas that simply should not be the subject of private property rights. And those were the science and nature and what they called abstract ideas. So one possible area where we may come somewhat closer to each other is the idea that unlike mathematical algorithms or natural phenomenon like existing genes, maybe there are things like software where in some circumstances it's really not an abstract idea. It's a concrete set of activities that was really of human creation that could potentially fall within the scope of patentability. At the end of the day, it's really, as I say, about what kind of innovation policy. And what's interesting to me about this, going back to the Bilski case, is that the government's position is one of the three constitutional arguments, although not framed as a constitutional argument, but as a statutory argument. And that is that technology is what the patent system is for, and Congress didn't intend to change the historic parameters of what technology meant. If you look at their en banc brief in Bilski, what they said was the technological focus of the Patent Act and the Patent Clause informs the outer limits of subject matter eligibility under 101. So here, at least the government is saying, one of these constitutional concerns that the patent system should be limited technology should be the basis on which we interpret the statute. And what's going on in something like a business method, notwithstanding the patents that you recited, Michael, is that that's not what the patent system is for.
This discussion of history is really fascinating. I think it might be very surprising to many people to hear patent lawyers who and patent scholars who are very concerned about innovation and new technology discussing at length old 19th century cases and quoting justices from opinions written in 1817.
Well, it's no surprise you would be interested in this, Adam.
Michael, do you have any thoughts on the Bilski case itself, on the patent at issue, and with all the usual caveats, of course, with predicting where the Supreme Court might go with this, what might happen in the coming months?
I do, and it follows from what Josh has just talked about innovation policy. I'm fundamentally worried about the Supreme Court setting broad innovation policy based on a single patent before it. I also worry about Congress setting innovation policy because of public choice problems, but that's a whole other issue. And so what we have in Bilski is what I believe to be an extremely weak patent. I've written elsewhere, I wrote an op-ed on this when it was before the Federal Circuit, that I think the Bilski claim is obvious. I think it's got all sorts of other problems. But I worry that the weakness of the underlying invention, it would cause the Supreme Court to kick it out on subject matter grounds rather than sending it back and saying, look, this is a process. It does do something. It is a series of steps designed to achieve a goal. And now, Patent Office, do your job and reject this on the right reasons. And so, on the right grounds. And so I worry that broad technological policy and innovation policy is being set on a single case at bar and a single weak patent at bar. I would much prefer to see a very strong patent, a very innovative, new, completely non-obvious patent being looked at so that the court would at least be able to set its policy on grounds other than the underlying merits of the claim for other reasons. My prediction, with the usual caveats, is the court is going to cabin subject matter somehow. There's too much dicta in the past to say that abstract ideas, et cetera, are patentable, despite my arguments to the contrary. What they do with this particular patent, I don't know. But I think there's going to be some subject matter limitations.
So, Michael, it sounds like you're applying to patent law a variation of the old saw, but here it goes, a bad patent makes bad law.
Basically, yes.
Yes.
Basically,
Joshua,
yes. And that's been true of all patentable subject matter cases.
Mm-hmm. Josh, we started with Michael, so we'll let you have the last word.
I largely agree with Michael. I think everyone would have liked to see a harder case. This, you know, on the merits, this was an 11-1 decision. It was unpatentable in the Federal Circuit. It's not totally clear why the Supreme Court took it if they're just going to affirm that this is not patentable. So I do think that, again, Michael's right, that the Supreme Court is looking for an opportunity to weigh in and give further advice about where the limits are. And in doing so, it really is hard to predict. There were only three judges who dissented from the dismissal of the LabCorp case, which dealt with a method of diagnosing a particular vitamin deficiency condition.
Which three justices were those?
Justice Souter, who is leaving, Justice Breyer, and Justice Stevens. Justice Stevens may see this as an opportunity to get his colleagues, four of his colleagues, including potentially new Justice Sotomayor, to reaffirm the approach that he had adopted in Parker v. Flook back in 1978. So that gives you a feel for how long Justice Stevens has been looking at these issues. But in any event, I do agree that this may not be the best case to really try to figure out how to draw the hard lines. The good news in that regard is there will be more amicus briefing from more industries than one could possibly shake a stick at. So at least if there's concern about how innovation policy will be affected, the court will hear it. They just may not hear any clear lines that they can draw that will help them to distinguish this particular bad patent from some of the ones that people may think should be upheld.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Josh, and thank you, Michael. I'm just going to close by noting that this is the Supreme Court's eighth cert grant in the patent law area in the past 3 years, and this last one certainly promises to be perhaps the most important of them all, especially given the types of issues talked about by Josh and Michael. Thank you both for having a wonderful discussion on this topic, and we hope everyone enjoyed this podcast on the Bilski cert grant.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federal Society multimedia, please visit our website at federalsociety.org/multimedia.